and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, a movie podcast where we talk all things movies. And this week, we will be reviewing we'll be reviewing Phantom Thread. quick jab in there. The fact that movie made $137 million on opening weekend is disgusting. And I don't know anybody that saw that. And so that's the part that is most interesting about that to me. It's just weird. I don't get who goes to see that.
People that don't tell their friends they're going to see it.
I'm curious, do you think every single person in a 50 Shades theater is there by themselves?
Based on the line that I saw going into the IMAX version as I was finishing Phantom
Thread. You saw a line for it?
Oh, there was a line for the IMAX on Thursday night previews last week, and there were like large groups together, like 8-10 college age girls, a few couples, a few like Ooh. Two guys, two girls. I don't know, man. I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyways, let's get past that because we've already done 2 minutes on that. But we were going to review Phantom Thread this week. My name is Cameron Slinian, and I'm joined tonight by Trevor Allison.
Hello.
Jake Brown couldn't be with us tonight because he is a rock star out there shooting big commercials.
He's actually,
so he'll be
actually
back next
a filmmaker.
Week, he is the actual one that is involved in the industry that we just talk about. But he'll be back next week for our review of Black Panther, which I'm starting to get unrealistically hyped.
I'm riding the hype train off the cliff. I am all yes. aboard.
All aboard. Ah ha 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 ha. To quote Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, is there any way that it's not? My biggest worry is that it's like good and we walk out of it and we're all like, that was fine. But is it the greatest Marvel movie of all time? Like everybody's been touting it. Hoy. I don't know.
I think its floor is really good. I think that's as bad as it can be.
Yeah. I think that the worst that it is like a B plus. But I'm honestly expecting it to be like A plus plus. It has everything. It has acting. It has story. It has mythos. It has
like this
emotions,
is,
comedy. Like
this is the time that superheroes get a Best Picture nom. Right here.
Yes. Like this is the film that does it.
I mean, I hope it's that good and I hope it gets it. I'm all in on this one. Super excited.
I think Get Out came out the same weekend last year and got a nomination, so we are doing away with old conventions of Oscar season and just letting things slide. Ooh. Wait, hold on. We're not seeing Samson this weekend?
Samson, coming to a Christian school Bible class in 15 years near you.
Yes, accurate. But let's go ahead and talk. I guess with just one piece of news item that's a very intriguing little bit if it ends up being true, but Joaquin Phoenix might end up playing the Joker in the Todd Phillips directed, Todd Phillips being the guy that directed the Hangover movies, and a Scorsese produced film. Joaquin Phoenix may play the Joker. He may play the. That's. Am I excited about that? Where are you? Like where are you sit on that, Trevor?
Here's the thing: the Joker is an interesting role because everyone knows exactly what it is, but no one, very few people, can do it well. I think that Heath Ledger, and the problem is that you have the Heath Ledger performance. Of the Joker that exists, which
literally won Best Supporting Actor. I mean, it doesn't get more acclaimed than a comic book movie winning an acting award.
Right. And Jack Nicholson was great in the Tim Burton Batman. But those are two of
but in a completely different way.
Right. And those are two of the greats. I mean, Jack Nicholson is one of the greats of all time. Can do just about anything. But I think that there's maybe four people alive that could play the Joker, and Joaquin Phoenix is one of them.
Who are the other ones?
I mean, not fair, but Daniel Day-Lewis can play anything, which we know that to be true. I mean, Jared Leto was not awful. It's kind of up his alley.
Trevor.
It's kind of up his alley. It's a different kind of take.
Did you see it?
Yeah. It's not.
Trevor.
I mean, the movies.
All right. Well, that's all we have for tonight. We are ending the podcast. We will be gone forever. Good night and good luck.
I mean, I think another person, I think a younger Willem Dafoe could have done the Joker. I think that's in his range.
Yeah, but I watch what he did with Green Goblin, and I'm like, that was fine for Green Goblin, but that as a Joker, I think, would have been weird.
Sure. But I think Joaquin Phoenix can kind of channel some of that weirdness from Gladiator and the kind of feel of the master. I think he's got the experience and the talent to pull this role off. Now, what I'm envisioning for this film is the Rotten Tomatoes blurb is going to say something like the fresh take on the story and Joaquin Phoenix's performance is not quite enough to pull this movie into being something worth watching over and over again.
I could see that very easily being it. So Trevor, you bring up an interesting point. When Joaquin Phoenix was first being talked about for this role, it was, I don't know if I can see that. And then I remembered the jail scene from The Master. And I was suddenly like, okay, he could do this. I think he could do it. I think he's got like the right kind of like physicality as an actor to do it. Because that's the thing, is the Joker isn't just like a voice and a dialogue. There's a physicality to him of how he moves and carries himself. That's terrifying.
Right. And I think he's someone,
I think Joaquin Phoenix could do that.
Yeah, and I think he's someone that I feel like, I mean I'm not here notwithstanding. I think he's someone who actually
Did you ever watch that? Did we watch that together?
No, I've seen like clips of it. I haven't seen the whole thing. I really want to. I just haven't gotten around to it. That notwithstanding, he's someone who really sells out for any role. And he's played some good roles in some mediocre movies before. So
yeah.
If this movie isn't good, it's not going to be because of him, I don't think.
No, I don't think it would. The interesting thing to me, though, is that he was offered, or at least was the front runner for playing Doctor Strange in the Marvel movies, and turned it down because he didn't want to be a part of a movie universe. And I understand that this wouldn't be like a universe film, but would be more of a it's a one-off standalone type film. But I don't know, it's just such an interesting choice for him. I'll be interested to see if he ends up taking the role, what he's able to do with it, because it's definitely a different direction for him, I think, than anything that he's ever done. Yeah, I mean, the interesting tidbit is that it's an Joker origin film, and so there's a chance that we don't even see him like costumed out as the Joker, maybe like the last shot of the movie, mm-hmm. other than that.
Yeah.
Which I think lends itself to his wheelhouse of, okay, that's an interesting way to, it's a Joker movie, but it's not a Joker movie in terms of that. But Todd Phillips is just the interesting choice here. He's had some hits and misses, but you never know. He could be good.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and get into some trailers, because this past week there were a couple trailers that dropped that I think are worth mentioning. The first of which is the trailer for Venom starring Tom Hardy that didn't show any of Venom. Now, when I first watched the trailer, I was like, interesting. You show a Venom trailer, which I'm curious, like, outside of the comic book world, how much name recognition that has. Like, does the everyday person on the street know, like, oh, I think that's the villain to Spider-Man? Like, I'm curious what that is to other people. But then I read a tweet that said the same people complaining about Venom not showing Venom are the same people who tweet out like how frustrated they are with studios giving everything away in trailers. And I was suddenly like, okay, I'm fine with this trailer now.
Yeah, I don't know why you don't show us Venom unless you're not done with the CGI.
But you think like if you're put, the movie doesn't come out until I think October or November.
Right.
And so you think like if we're putting out a trailer, we're, I mean, they have like 6 or 7, 8 months. 600, 700, 800 months. You got quite a bit of time to, yeah, it doesn't come out until October 5th. So you've got 7 months until this movie comes out. I don't get what the rush is to put that out. I don't think it would be that.
Also, was there, it kind of moved kind of fast. Was there a glimpse of Tom Holland in this? Cause I didn't see any.
I don't think so. I don't think there's been conflicting reports, but the one that seems to predominantly show up is the one that says this will be in the same universe, but it won't, like, there won't be any overlap.
Right. That's what I heard the agreement that Sony and Marvel came to was that Sony would make movies that would have Spider-Man being played by Tom Holland, but they were, even though Tom Holland was playing Spider-Man, they don't intersect with the MCU.
Yes.
So, but like, I don't know why you don't show Tom Holland in this, because everyone loves Tom Holland as Peter Parker.
That may be part of the agreement, is that Marvel's like, look, he's in our films. Like, we don't want crossover. We need this character to stay as we need him to appear on screen. And we don't want you guys going off and doing something that's going to mess with the continuity of our universe.
Yeah. I just,
because I mean, there's, if he's in this movie, there's no way that like Marvel doesn't tie that in then somehow to Spider-Man 2.
Right.
Like, you would have to make some sort of reference.
Right. So it is weird. The movie doesn't really look particularly good. It's just a teaser. Although Tom Hardy and Michelle Williams are in it, so it's probably going to be well acted, if nothing else.
And Ruben Fleischer is not a bad director. I mean, he's not like the prestige level of like the tops of the tops, but I love Zombieland. I think that film is incredible. Yes. 30 minutes or less and Gangster Squad weren't great, but they at least had like style to them.
I'm guessing that Venom is not going to have the same feel as Zombieland though, based on,
I'm
going to
guess
teaser.
Not.
It looks very
Zombieland
serious.
Was one of those films that like, I remember seeing it and being like, that is 100% different than what I was expecting to walk out or walk into.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I felt about it too. So yeah, I don't know about this Venom thing is interesting. It's almost like portraying him as the protagonist, which I think Venom, especially if you're doing it without a lot of Spider-Man, Venom is most interesting as a Eddie Brock versus Venom kind of thing.
Yeah, I think he's definitely like in Venom's like more recent runs in comics, he's kind of played like this like anti-hero type figure. And I mean, it's probably, because Tom Hardy's very good at playing that kind of anti-hero role. Just look at Mad Max. So I think I'd be willing to bet that that's the way that they're going. But man, Tom Hardy just doesn't do bad things. And so it's hard to imagine this, like him taking this role and it not living up to what Tom Hardy's done before.
Yeah, I agree.
The next trailer came out today, and it's one that Jake had texted us about. I have some preconceived thoughts on this movie just based off of, you know, opinions of people in the movie. But Jake texted us today and just said, guys, I can't help but smile as I watch the new Rampage trailer. Even though I know I should hate it, I can't. What was your thought when you watched the Rampage trailer?
So after Jake texted us and said that, I watched it, and I don't get it. It's the same trailer as the first one. It's not even that different.
There's one new shot that's kind of cool, and it's that the wolf jumping out of the building and then kind of gliding.
Yeah, it's a flying squirrel wolf.
Yeah, that's the, I was like, wait, do wolves have that? Like, there is a second where I questioned everything that I knew about wolves, and I was like, wait, they don't have webbing.
This, okay. This, I don't understand. This is based on a video game that was fun for 12 minutes.
This is based on one of the most basic video games. Go to a town, destroy town, fight other animals.
I don't understand. I mean, it's, but I will say, these kind of movies, like we said with Skyscraper last week, Dwayne The Rock Johnson gets every bit of quality that can be squeezed out of these kind of movies. Because
I mean, just look at Jumanji.
He sells everything. He has like the it factor that you can't teach. That's just, I mean, everyone knows it. Everyone, I mean, you've seen him in anything, you know it. That's just who he is. But also, like, I mean, I think we're like slowly careening to a point where we have to review this on the podcast.
Oh, I think this is a for sure review. I don't think there's any way that we get out of reviewing this. I often think, man, we're probably, you know, we have to be in the darkest timeline. The world's just in such a dark place. And then I think Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the most bankable movie star in Hollywood right now. All right. Maybe it's not the darkest timeline.
20 years ago was a up-and-coming wrestling superstar. 25 years ago was playing defensive tackle for the University of Miami.
Yes.
I mean...
And before that, rocking a sweet fanny pack and black sweater.
For real. So, what a life, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. What a life.
What a life. I mean, this... I think I'm, like, hesitant about this movie. But if Dwayne The Rock Johnson wasn't in this movie, I'd be 100% out.
Yeah, that's exactly how
I feel.
Strictly
because he's in it, I'm like, okay, I will see this movie. I am at least somewhat interested. Now, the director is the same guy that directed San Andreas, which is just not good. But, I mean, I just need to latch onto a movie star and then just start making movies with them. I think that's the way to do it. You just find that one person, latch onto them, and then you can just direct movies with them.
I mean,
even though they're probably directing movies,
especially when that person is Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yes, my goodness, he's gonna have himself a year between Rampage and Skyscraper, which just looks. Why am I interested in that movie? I don't know.
I'm not. You probably
he also has
be.
Another one called Fighting With My Family that's coming out later this year. I think it's a comedy drama based off the life of some WWE wrestler that he will be in as himself. And I think he's producing it.
But, oh, and written and directed by Stephen Merchant.
Yes. That was the interesting piece that I was like, wait, there's something about this that I'm like, what is it?
That makes it very interesting.
Yes. So, all right. Well, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, you've got us somewhat interested. What's interesting is that this trailer also kind of gives us an update on the story. For the longest time, I was like, are you honestly going to tell me that like the front half of every single trailer is like, he's best friends with this ape trying to protect him. And then the back half is like, let's go take down this ape. The trailer makes it seem like the wolf and the ape, George, if I'm remembering right, end up becoming friends and good guys and will fight the giant crocodile.
While using like construction cranes as a weapon.
Yes. And I should also mention that this isn't just a normal, massive, prehistoric crocodile. This crocodile also has the reflexes of the world's fastest cat because it can grab aerial fighter planes out of the air with its jaws.
I mean, there you go.
So, I just, you know, I don't want this movie to be smart. Don't try and give me a bunch of smart, sciencey talk about we need to do this to get George back to this. Just say we invented this thing that makes animals massive for war purposes. And then go and just have yourself a dumb, fun time. That's all I want.
That's what I think I said that to you guys. This seems like a movie where trying to tell a story is going to get in the way of awesomeness.
Yes. Go with the route of Fast and the Furious, throw out story, and just have cool action scenes. That's all we want. Nobody will question you for it. Just look at how well it's worked out for the Fast and the Furious series. I'm a huge Fast and the Furious fan, and I could hardly tell you what the plot of any of the movies is because it doesn't matter. It's not 100% true. I could do a pretty big breakdown.
Going to do one more heist before we get out of the game. That's the plot.
We got one last ride for family. Man.
Rinse, repeat.
That guy. That guy. You know, he's a great guy, but is he Uncle Drew? Uncle Drew, the famous character played by Kyrie Irving, formerly of the Cleveland Cavaliers, now of the Boston Celtics, that was a Pepsi commercial and is now being made into a movie where Uncle Drew, an older version of Kyrie Irving, plays basketball with his nephew, Lorel Howery.
Okay, so I can't even, I don't even know what to say about this. I had no idea this was being made. And I saw the trailer on IMDb's front page this morning, and I was just like, what? And so I watched the trailer, and basically what this is a series of webisodes that for some reason were all cut together to be a feature-length film.
Yes. Like one night they went out and they ended up filming, instead of like a 4-minute online commercial, they filmed like 20 minutes worth of stuff, and then they're like, let's just do that a couple more times and we got ourselves a movie.
What percentage of the budget in this movie do you think is actors' salaries? Is it like 80% of the budget, 90% of the budget?
Oh, it has to be something absurd like that. When you have people like, so you have Kyrie, and then on his crew or his team of basketball legends is an old Shaquille O'Neal, an old Chris Webber, an old Reggie Miller, and an old Nate Robinson.
And all wearing, which Nate Robinson's not that old, but the other three guys, you know, are like in their mid-40s or late 40s. They're all wearing old man makeup to make them look even older. So I don't...
Yes.
What the heck is going on here? Also...
I love the fact that Reggie Miller, one of the greatest three-point shooters of all time, is blind in this movie.
I mean, this is definitely going to have some laughs. But yes. I see this basically, this is the same thing as like MacGruber and Superstar. Like it's just, it's a movie based on a skit that is like a one joke skit. So yeah. I just don't understand.
You also, on top of that, have Lisa Leslie.
Oh yeah.
Tiffany Haddish, uh-huh. And Nick Kroll.
Yeah, Nick Kroll doing one of his characters from, you know, before, probably, because he has a million of them.
Probably someone from the Nick Kroll show. It's just, like, the jokes in here are so, like, there's a joke where Shaq punches Uncle Drew, and he's like, that's the first free throw you ever made. And it's just... Trevor, I hope you're right. I hope this is like MacGruber level of self-aware. And if it is, it'll be one of the funniest movies ever made, because MacGruber is one of the funniest movies ever made. But I just don't see it going that way. I jokingly tweet or texted us in the group that it was going to be our generation's Space Jam, but I don't think that it will get anywhere close to that good.
I don't understand. I will say the greatest value in this film might be the gifts that come out of it.
Yes.
that seems like there's a lot of gif potential here.
This movie will be the Jimmy Fallon of movies. And I mean that because Jimmy Fallon's show is set up around what can we do in 5 minutes on my show multiple times that will get repeat views online. And I think this movie is going to be like, man, that 5-minute scene was great. Okay, boring transition. Okay, that 5-minute scene was interesting as well.
Yep.
I will say the guy that's directing it, big time director, directed Drumline and Mr. 3000.
Drumline is one of those movies that's pretty good, but not as good as everyone says.
Oh, I love Drumline.
I think it's pretty good.
I think I'm like grandfathered into liking that movie. There's all these movies from like childhood that you watch before you kind of have that taste or judgment that you would have later in life, and you like them later in life regardless, even though you know that they're bad because they have that, like Triple X featuring Vin Diesel. I know it's a terrible movie, but I'm kind of grandfathered into liking that movie from my childhood.
Sure. No, I understand.
So that's Uncle Drew, comes out June 29th. Maybe we go see this.
I can't do it.
Trevor, what if I pay for your ticket?
Maybe. Even so.
How much would it take? I'm always curious in this. How much would it take? I asked my brother-in-law this question this week. He hates clowns, and I asked him how much it would take if for someone to pay him for him to watch it. And I was surprised at his answer. He said $500. And I thought that was way low from what he was going to say.
Oh, I mean
$500 is doable.
I mean, yeah, let's see what some reviews and what some buzz is like. But I'm skeptical.
No. We don't need to see reviews or buzz. We just need to go watch the movie. You just gotta feel it. To quote the great Bernie Mac.
Rest in peace.
Ocean's 13. Alrighty. Well, that's all we have for trailers and news. Let's go ahead and get into our review of Phantom Thread, which is wildly different than the summer blockbuster things that we've been talking about up until this point. Because this movie is at the same time familiar and unlike anything I've ever seen before in my entire life. Trailer, what were your general... Trevor. Well, not trailer. Trevor. Gosh, I'm just going to start calling people by movie names that start with the same letter. Trevor, what were your thoughts on this movie?
Okay, so this is an interesting movie. It's kind of right in that like perfect Oscar-y wheelhouse of being artsy, but not too artsy.
Oh my gosh, it's so artsy.
So, but I mean, it's still... it's not like avant-garde, I'll say. It doesn't go that far.
It's not like Tree of Life.
Right.
That's fair. I'll give you
thank
that.
Thank God Terrence Malick wasn't anywhere near this. So this is a very good movie, but this is one of the least accessible movies I've ever seen. The potential target audience for this is incredibly low. I don't know who else wants to see this besides film majors. And people interested in 1950s England, maybe fashion. It's kind of slow and odd. It kind of meanders to its conclusion. But it is interesting. It's incredibly well acted. The score is great. The cinematography is very good. There are some amazingly set up shots here. The production design is very good. It's technically great. The story is much more interesting than it seems like it is at first, and has become more interesting the more I thought about it. But yeah, this is a good movie, a really good movie, but it's just not for the masses, definitely.
Yeah, this isn't... I can't picture your average moviegoer going to see this. Now, I say that, but I went to a 4 p.m. screening on a Tuesday, and it was... I think on a Monday, and it was packed. Now, most of those people were probably retired older women, but there was some people my age mixed in there. And, you know, I'm surprised by this film. I'm pleasantly surprised. We talked about this film quite a bit leading up to it in that every time we would mention it, I feel like it was... If Daniel Day-Lewis and PTA weren't involved, we would have no interest in this film whatsoever. But simply because Paul Thomas Anderson's directing it, it's Daniel Day-Lewis's final film, it's Daniel Day-Lewis acting in something, which happens once a decade, we're interested strictly because of that. But I think this movie is a very interesting look at something that it is not... shown in the trailer, because I think this movie is a very different movie than what's portrayed in the advertising leading up to it. I think that here in the movie, what we're getting is a study in control and in manipulation of people. It's like Trevor said, it's got a beautiful score. It's got amazing cinematography. For a movie that not a lot happens and it's just kind of like dialogue, I was enthralled the entire time. I was interested beginning to end, and I like this movie a lot, but I can't specifically put my finger on what holds me back from thinking it's an even better movie than where I'm at. Like, I'll show my cards a little early. I think this movie is probably like a B+, A-. But I don't know what keeps it from, like, I've been trying to think about this ever since I saw it. We're recording this Wednesday, so it's been 48 hours, and I've been trying to think about what's holding me back from liking this movie more. Trevor, what are things in this movie that hold you back from liking it more?
No part of this film resonates with me on a personal level. The setting, the characters, their way of life, their interests, their actions, are just so different from who I am. I think that's a big part of it for me. And it's not, the problem is that it doesn't have any one thing to hang its hat on. It's not exceptionally funny. It's not exceptionally romantic. It's not exceptionally clever. It is exceptionally well acted, but I'm kind of saying from a story standpoint. It is unique in a lot of ways, but I think it's like very good in a lot of ways, but it's not great in any one single way. And I think that's what is kind of keeping it for me, for being on like kind of that upper echelon of like a truly great movie.
This is something that I constantly, wrestle with, is this idea of a movie resonating with me. And I've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast of, you know, the movies I end up liking the most are the movies that ultimately resonate with me on some sort of emotional level. And I don't think I have much in common with Woodcock or Alma or Cyril, but I think what this movie does more than anything is bring you into that world. It's, and I keep feeling this way about Lady Bird too. There's not a lot in Lady Bird that I connect with on a personal level, but it brings you into that world and is so beautiful in how it does it, and so tender and caring and told with such affection that there's something to be admired just for the way that the story is able to at least relate to you on some level, because let's face it, none of us have anything to relate to 1950s London and fashion couture dress designing at that time. But it uses that as a vehicle to tell this story of a man who's obsessed with his control and his routine, but at the same time needs a muse and needs love and what he's willing to go to in order to keep the right balance of that control and that muse that he needs in his life.
It's almost, and I'll kind of talk about this in a minute. My idea of what the theme of this film was changed like 8 times while I was watching it.
Completely.
But I think that I've to borrow something that I read recently. Denis Villeneuve once said in an interview that Close Encounters of the Third Kind is a movie about what it's like to make a movie, with Richard Dreyfuss's character kind of being the director, so to speak, and kind of telling the story in an allegorical way. I think that this is maybe a broader allegory of just what it's like to be an artist and to live with an artist and to experience life with an artist. And I think that it seems, a lot of it seems very personal from PTA. a lot of it feels very intentional and very real. Maybe drawing directly from his life and his relationships.
Yeah, I think that's something that's definitely true, especially when you look at his body of work and how they relate to his life. I mean, Punch Drunk Love is kind of that way. I think The Master is one of the most amazing films I've ever seen in my entire life. And what he's doing with that movie is he's telling a story that's essentially telling of L. Ron Hubbard and the early roots of Scientology, while also making it about, you know, if you look at that movie as like, he is the master and it's what all of these people want. He's trying to constantly give and getting nothing in return. And, you know, he has his audience and fans just constantly wanting more and not respecting. And I mean, there are so many layers to that movie. And I think you can also, Trevor, I think you're right, do that with this movie as well and break it down on a level of, what does that look like in his personal life? Interestingly enough, with him and his wife, Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, I forgot they were married until I was reading about this movie. I was like, oh yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a thing. They're married. Okay, cool. So let me ask you this before we move further. What's your background with PTA? Because I feel like for a lot of people, they're either they think his work's mediocre or they think that he's the greatest director of our time.
I have seen Punch Drunk Love, but it's been a really long time. I remember thinking it was weird but interesting. I've seen maybe parts of The Master. I've also seen whatever parts of like There Will Be Blood and Boogie Nights they show you in film classes and stuff. So I don't have a ton of experience with PTA. It's kind of one of those things where I've kind of suffered from not having anyone around me who has an interest in his movies. That's kind of a big reason that I haven't seen a lot of them, because a lot of people, you even see a trailer for PTA and they're like, nope. I don't need that, or that's weird, or that's too out there. So I don't have a ton of experience. This is the definitely the first time in like 6 or 7 years I've seen one of his movies in its entirety. So yeah, not a lot of experience, all that to say.
Yeah, I think I've seen all of his movies with the exception of Inherent Vice. I didn't see from a couple years ago. Punch Drunk Love, I think, oddly enough, says the most about what he's capable as a director, because you see what he's able to do with Adam Sandler as an actor. But then at the same time, you know, he comes back 5 years later after that and puts out The Master, or puts out There'll Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis, which delivers one of the most haunting performances of all time. And, you know, it's Daniel Day-Lewis. I wasn't kidding. He acts once every decade, but it's legitimately every 5 years. He did There'll Be Blood in 2007. He did Lincoln in 2012, and he did Phantom Thread in 2017. And he's incredible in all of them, but two of his movies are Paul Thomas Anderson movies that I don't know if it's they just know how to work together, but those are two of his, in my opinion, best performances.
Yeah, definitely. I will say, I have also, I have seen several of PTA's music videos. He directs a lot of music videos, and he's very good at that as well. Especially the studio videos from Haim that came out last year are amazing. Not only because of him, but because the Haim sisters are amazing too. But yeah, he's definitely someone who understands how to tell a story, which I mean is the most important thing about being a director.
Right. And I think he also, what's incredible, and I don't think that he gets enough credit for, is his dialogues. I mean, you constantly hear people talking about like, oh, Tarantino writes an amazing dialogue, but it's like, when you watch Paul Thomas Anderson movies, there's not a lot going on, but you're constantly fascinated by the language and how these people interact. And that's, I mean, we need to give the guy more credit for just his writing ability alone, because his scripts are just incredible. He's fantastic at what he does in that regard. And
Yeah, the words used in this script and the pacing used are so authentic. It helps it feel so real.
And the plant and payoffs that are delivered in this movie are so subtle and natural and like worked into the film in a way that it's when they pay off, it's like a little treat, or to use another term that would be more applicable to this film. It's like a nice mushroom hit found out in the woods.
Hey-o.
That's a inside joke for spoilers out there. But let's go ahead and talk the big thing in this movie, which is Daniel Day-Lewis and his final performance. What did you think of him in this role?
I thought he was great. I want to avoid doing the comparison thing, but it's a lot easier for him because he has so few roles.
Right.
I've not seen There Will Be Blood, and I know that everyone says that that's his magnum opus. Mm-hmm. I thought him as Abraham Lincoln was just astonishing. Just absolutely mind blowing. He was everything that you read and picture Abraham Lincoln to be. I think this wasn't quite on that, but I'm talking about like Lincoln might be like the greatest acting performance of all time. It's definitely in the conversation.
Wow.
I would put it in the conversation. But I thought he was great. He was fantastic. He's probably going to win the Oscar.
Okay. So do you think between him, Chalamet, I don't think Kaluuya is in the race, and I really don't think Chalamet is in the race, but between him and Oldman, I guess. Do you think he pulls this one out over Gary Oldman?
Oldman may,
and I get that's hard to say considering we haven't seen The Darkest Hour.
Oldman may get some sentimental votes, not having won before, but.
But do you think Daniel Day-Lewis gets sentimental votes, and like this is his final? Well, like, if I'm an Academy voter, I'm giving him. Well, maybe not. Maybe if he doesn't win it,
he has three.
Come back.
Right? Is that right?
He has three. He has the most of an actor of all time.
The thing is that in this film, he's the centerpiece of everything while not being someone who talks a lot.
Right. But it's his looks and mannerisms.
Yeah,
you really feel like you're almost watching a documentary on a fashion designer.
He does way more without talking than he does with talking in this film, and it's really incredible.
Those looks that he gives kind of like down his nose, or like as his head slightly tilted and his eyes are at the top of his brows. I mean, it's just menacing.
Yeah, he is so good. I mean, he's the best. It's not even really up for debate. But yeah, I mean, his performance lived up to my expectations here, and I have incredibly high expectations for him.
Right. I feel like, you know, you have those expletives thrown out there all the time of like, wow, that person's the greatest living this, that. I truly feel, and I really can't think of another person in the same league, but I really do feel like, Trevor, like what you just said, I really feel like he's the greatest living actor today.
I don't like I said, I'm not even sure that you can make a strong case for anyone else. You can make a strong case for like five or six guys that are in that like next echelon easily.
Right.
But there's no one that consistently delivers these, just like I don't know. Astonishing is the only word that I can think of to really do credit.
And he was in a film in 2009, a musical called Nine, that I think got a bunch of awards nominations, but I don't remember him getting much acclaim for it. But I mean, when you look at since 2000, in 2002, he did Gangs of New York, Academy Award nomination. He did The Ballad of Jack and Rose, which he didn't get nominated for anything. And then he did There Will Be Blood, won the Academy Award. He did Nine, nominated for Golden Globe. He did Lincoln, won the Academy Award. He did Phantom Thread, nominated, pending, possibly going to win. I mean, the guy's I want to stay on topic with Phantom Thread, but it's hard to talk about somebody's final performance without taking a look at everything leading up to this, because he brings so much weight because of the everything that he's done up until this point. Like when you look at, like, so go kind of go through his roles and go, you can even go back a little bit farther than that and go, you know, Last of the Mohicans. And then from there go, you know, The Boxer, Gangs of New York, There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread. I mean, he brings such different things to each of those roles in a chameleon-esque way that you don't see replicated by anybody else. And yes, the argument could be made, he's not in as much, so his areas of fault where he may have a miss or two are less, but in the past 10 years, he's done 4 films, 2 of which he won the Academy Award for Best Actor, and 1 of which he's nominated for and with a pending. So he would go 3 for 4 on movies as far as winning Best Actor.
That's pretty crazy.
I don't think there's enough positive things that we could say about Daniel Day-Lewis in the length of this podcast, but what he's able to do here, I haven't seen Gary Oldman in The Darkest Hour. I've talked at length before on this podcast, but my love for Gary Oldman, he's an honorable mensch, both like in multiple decades. I mean, he has a career spanning years. That's just incredible. And there's part of me that goes, I think, and I haven't seen The Darkest Hour. Well, I'll say that once again. I feel like I've said it multiple times. I haven't seen The Darkest Hour, but knowing what I know about Phantom Thread, if Gary Oldman wins, he fully deserves it. But part of it, I feel like in the minds of some voters, would be a career win. Because I just don't see anything acting-wise that would be better than what Daniel Day-Lewis did in this film.
Yeah, I agree.
What did you think about... So let's get into spoilers. If you haven't seen this movie, Phantom Thread's out now. It's nominated for multiple awards. I think it's nominated for 8 Academy Awards. So if you're somebody who likes to catch up on Academy Award-nominated films before the ceremony on March 4th, this is something that should definitely be on your list. But let's go ahead and get into spoilers. So there's a certain, when this movie is, you know, metaphorically fired out of the cannon and takes off at the beginning of the movie, I feel like it's going one way and then just kind of in one instance, just kind of sharp turns and is something completely different. And that's the scene where, you know, Alma kind of being upset with Woodcock ends up poisoning his tea so that she can take care of him, because when he's at his most vulnerable, he is then able to be loved at his easiest, which is an incredibly like intriguing thought. But what did you think of that turn and that new direction that the movie went at that point?
I mean, yeah, that was definitely interesting. I was kind of surprised by it. I at one point wasn't sure if he was going to die or not, and that was going to be, so I was, and kind of intrigued to see the fallout from that, if that was going to happen.
And that was the part, that was where I was like, he's going to die, and then because I was like checking my watch knowing how long this movie was, going, okay, and then the last like 30 minutes are going to be Alma taking over the business.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing. It is, it's a surprise, but like looking back, I like should have felt it coming in some ways. Just like kind of her mounting frustrations with him. But
that's what I'm saying about PTA, is that with these plants and payoffs, he's able to work them in there so subtly that when it happens, it's not this like, when the plants happen, it's not this obvious, like, oh, that's going to end up coming back. It's this like subtle thing that ends up just kind of weaving and being molded in there until it's this natural next step that you're like, wow, yeah. Oh, that makes sense considering what had happened. I hadn't thought of that.
Right. Yeah. I think that his greatest skill might be in like normalizing crazy behavior. and making it seem logical from an early starting point and kind of building to it. But yeah, that was, it definitely kind of took a turn. That's when I kind of, like I said, I moved on from one guess of what the theme of this film was to another at that point, which didn't end up being my final decision as to what I would say the theme is, until we get to see our second time with the mushrooms, in which it becomes this very weird, I don't even know what the right words are. This haunting realization of almost like self-awareness from Reynolds Woodcock of what he needs in life and who he needs around him and what he needs to happen to him.
Right.
And we end up with this theme of like, love is weird. and like whatever works for you is great. I feel like that's kind of what the overarching theme of this is.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is the end of the movie ends up being that scene where he discovers that Alma is poisoning him so that she can take care of him. And then, slowly starts to eat the omelet again because he understands that he needs it is just, it's gut wrenching. And it's one of those scenes where like my mouth was open just at shock of where this had gone, and it's twisted and weird, and
yeah, the delivery.
But it's
of,
not an unnatural thing for any of the characters.
Yeah, the delivery of "kiss me, my girl, before I'm sick" is just like bone chilling. Ugh. But yeah, like you said, it's set up by this idea of Reynolds being this guy who just kind of lives kind of at this
selfishly.
At this like selfish extreme.
Yes.
And somewhat maybe kind of coming to terms, especially talking about his mother and the death there, coming to terms with his old with or trying to come to terms with his advancing age and his own mortality.
Right. So
much to say that he's comforted by the fact of the dead watching over us, which I would hypothesize that he's not comforted that they're watching over us because they're there for us. He's comforted because that means that there's something else for him in the future.
Right.
I
think cause if we go on the theme of this movie is all about control, the biggest thing that you can't control is that at the end of all of this, there's death and you can't control death coming for you or not coming for you. You can't escape that. So I think that's a very good observation, Trevor. I think that's smart.
Yeah. I think this kind of goes into one of the things that I wrote in my notes was this is basically like a really good novel that your like 11th grade English teacher makes you read. And you like read the whole thing and you don't really get it. And then you start discussing it in class and you're like, oh wait, that's way better than I thought it was while I was reading it.
Right.
Because there's so much to this. I think that you could get something different out of this every time you watch it. The problem with this movie is that it's not really begging me to watch it again. That's kind of where what's keeping it from being great to me, I think.
Okay, but what? So then, why does a movie, in order for a movie to be great, why does it have to be rewatched multiple times?
Well, I'm not saying it has to be great. I'm saying that is one factor of being a great movie. I think the problem this is, and I can't really put my finger on it. I know it's a weird dichotomy between understanding that there's probably more to be gleaned from this film while also not being that interested in wanting to watch it again.
Has talking about the movie tonight made you like it anymore?
Maybe a little bit. It has kind of made me want to watch it again in the sense of, just kind of to pick up on some different things and to kind of maybe test some of the theories that we've discussed as to what certain things mean and where what was foreshadowed and not and all kinds of stuff like that. So, yeah, I guess I'm maybe liking it a little bit more after discussing it. But it's still, I know you said it at the beginning, I just can't put my finger on it, but there's just something that's a little something missing from this.
If this movie wins Best Picture, are you kind of like, yeah, that's fine?
Yeah, I'm not mad about it. It wouldn't be a very, it wouldn't be a super interesting choice to me.
It would be a by the books pick.
Right. This is the kind of movie that, really, it's the kind of movie that won Best Picture, like, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, where people would watch it. People would watch the Oscars.
Shakespeare in Love, We're Looking at You.
Right. People would watch the Oscars, see that this movie won Best Picture, go watch Best Picture and be like, I don't even know why they have the Oscars because I didn't think it was that good.
Right.
This is the kind of movie that is why people say things like that.
But I feel like, I mean, that's also just getting on the hype train. And, you know, we talk often about the parabola of hype, and I think that's people catching it at the peak. I mean, there's no way that you could be any more at the peak of hype than after, like, post-winning an Academy Award for Best Picture. I mean, nobody's going to... A film is not going to be, like, the best picture that you've ever seen if you're watching it post that award.
Right,
so,
right.
And that's always hard, is because, like, I hadn't seen Spotlight before Spotlight won. And then I watched it like the day after and I was like, that was okay. And then I think I watched it again like 6 months later and was like, that film's brilliant.
Yeah. I'm now ready to say, I said 5 minutes ago, I'm not too interested in watching it again. I'm willing to put this one on the shelf for like a year and then watch it again.
Right.
And see what it's.
Yeah, I would do that.
It doesn't quite have the, the Baby Driver, Blade Runner kind of thing where it's like, I need to see this again tomorrow if possible.
Yes. But I don't think that it's like Baby Driver and Blade Runner are begging to be those kind of movies where it's like, there's depth, there's layers, there's, it makes you feel something inside that, like for Baby Driver, like you want to be Baby and you want to be the person that's like, able to do those things, but at the end of the day, make the right decision for the girl. And it's like, it leaves you with that positive feeling. And I think because this film doesn't necessarily leave you with that positive feeling, it's not something that you're readily looking to jump back into. Like, I'm trying to think of a film like, well, that's not a good example because I did want to jump. I was going to say The Social Network, but I was like, no, I literally went to go see that movie the next day after I saw it the first time. I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example of that, of a movie that kind of left me feeling
this,
not like happy or like hopeful, but I was like, that's a good film.
It's not this movie, Phantom Thread, is not as emotional as this, but I would say that like Never Let Me Go is kind of in that category.
Yeah. I think that's a good example.
Like the great film, but it's just, so there's so much to it and it's so heavy that you maybe want to catch it again sometime in the future in your life, but not tomorrow.
Right. I think this is a film, and you could probably say this about a lot of PTA's films, but that will be studied by film majors, and the kids who are in film school right now are sitting there like, whether they actually believe this or not, saying it was a stunning masterpiece of cinema.
Right. This is a film that can show you the importance of framing and cinematography, even when there's not a lot of action going on.
Right. And I think that right there is when we talk about like the metaphorical sense of this film of being what's being told on screen is just as important for the actual like behind the scenes of the movie is, you know, when they talk about dressmaking, they're all about these details and the threading and the lace and how it all comes together. Or, you know, he runs through with the Belgian princess a list of like, are you a lace girl or blah, 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 blah. And are you like pearl or like gold or silver, all these different things. And so much of it is like in the details. And like a good dress isn't just like a piece of fabric that you just sew together right on the back and it's just one thing. It's there's details and love woven into it. And I think the same can be said about this movie in that, like, there's details and love constantly woven into this story. And it's told, like, this is something that could easily be mocked as, like, oh my gosh, that's the most, like, Oscar baity movie I've ever seen. And yes, it is somewhat, but it's so sincere in the way that it's told that it kind of falls out, or it's like, that's not something that's, like, prevalent on your mind as you're watching it. Trevor, do you have anything else to say about this film before we get to our ratings?
I think something that may make the listener laugh, I wrote down a list of kind of my thought progression of what I felt like the theme was of this film. So initially I thought this was something sort of highlighting those on the autism spectrum, based on a lot of Reynolds Woodcock's behaviors. I then moved on to the idea that maybe that wasn't quite accurate, but that geniuses are insane, and that's what we were going for. Next, I thought that at one point I thought that this might be a satire of high fashion when Reynolds and Alma go and take a dress off of a drunk bride in her hotel room, which felt very satirical to me. I'm not sure if it was intended that way, but that's how it felt or came across. And then I kind of went into this idea of maybe family are the only ones who can truly understand each other, with Cyril and Reynolds' relationship. Also, we haven't mentioned Leslie Manville. She was also nominated for an Oscar, mm-hmm. and she was amazing in this. Then I moved on to dressmaking as a metaphor for film and making a film, and I think there's something to that. And then there's kind of this interesting idea here of the desires for someone can be platonic without being sexual, and where Reynolds tells Alma, I feel as if I've been looking for you for a very long time. And it's like she's the perfect person to be his muse for dresses, but it's not like a sexual thing.
So it's not like romantic to him.
Right. But it's
because maybe he's not capable of that.
Right. But it's,
but on a like artistic level of like, you inspire me. Great.
Yeah. The interesting idea of being of something being superficial, but not romantic or sexual is really interesting. But then also I kind of landed on, you know, the idea of control and love and being weird and stuff. So that's kind of what just a little glimpse into kind of my thinking as I'm watching this film, kind of developing in my brain, this roller coaster that we went on that didn't have super high highs or super low lows, but still kind of took us all over the place.
Right. Do you think, and I'm sitting here just trying to think of, you know, we never fully answered the question of what was it about this movie that stops it from being an A+ and us fully, you know, diving into campaigning. Phantom Thread's for sure going to win Best Picture. Do you think how much the movie kind of was like tight-roping things and made you jump around thematically? Do you think that stopped you from liking it? Like, do you think that it's kind of tonal, like, because tonally it has a through line in the tone of things, but thematically and where the story kind of goes, it's not like a straight road that towards the end kind of takes a curve along a bend. It's this like backcountry road that's got potholes and dips, and you're curving around this end and then going down a hill, and I mean it's kind of just thematically goes places.
Yeah, I think that might be it. I think it's the viewer spends a little bit too much time trying to figure out what this is.
Right. And I think, so while you were on the theme side of it, I was on the story side of it. And I think that one of the things the movie does well is it kind of always stays one step ahead of its viewer in terms of the story. And every time I was kind of like, oh, okay, I see where they're going with this. They're going to go here. It kind of took a sharp turn almost immediately and went in a different direction. And that was something that I definitely respected.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple small things. One, the score was nominated for an Oscar, and I'm totally cool if it wins it. Johnny Greenwood did an amazing job with this score. There's score playing for, I don't know what, probably 75% of the movie. There's a lot of score and it works really well. My favorite line of the movie was was when Alma kind of first is involved with Reynolds, and she brings him tea while he's working and he doesn't like it. And she says, okay, I'm leaving. And he said, the tea is going out, but the interruption is staying right here with me. And that's something that I definitely want to use sometime when someone interrupts me when I'm feeling really snarky. Also, my last thing is the dressmaking scenes, but the way that they were shot and the way that they were feel, they were like oddly relaxing. Anytime someone was like working on a dress or like sewing, cutting, when they had like the models and the muses and they were like sizing them up for the dresses and everything, like it was very like a soothing experience to watch.
It's almost like you're watching like the Great British Baking Show and you're just kind of like, I just need to relax. I'm just going to watch these beautiful shots with this quaint music of a dress being made. Like, if that's put out as, like, a 5-minute just, like, online thing of, like, a dress being made, that would get, like, tons of viewers, and everybody would be like, look how soothing this is. If you want to be calmed, just watch this.
Yep, I agree.
That's a good point, Trev. So let's go ahead and get to our ratings for this film. What would you give Phantom Thread?
So, I really struggled doing my normal thing with numbers here, because there aren't a lot of numbers in this film. My number I'm pulling is the car that he drives when he's out in the country is a Bristol 405, which that car is amazing. It's beautiful.
Yes.
Also, it's the same car driven by Peter Skarsgård's character in An Education, which stars Carey Mulligan as well, and is an interesting companion piece for this film, I think, in a lot of ways.
I hadn't thought of that film.
I'm giving this a Bristol 353 out of Bristol 405, which lands it firmly in kind of that B+ territory, so you don't have to do any quick math or anything. For lots of reasons that we've kind of touched on. And this may be something where, on second watch, if I'm not trying to keep up so much thematically and kind of sink into it a little bit more, I could see my rating going up some. But right now, I'm solidly right in there, B+ area.
Nice. I like this film quite a bit. I know I talked about how there's something that keeps it from being like top tier for me, but talking about it and thinking about it and just kind of like where this story goes, it's an A for me. It's a solid film with, if this is Daniel Day-Lewis's final performance, it's amazing from beginning to end. And, you know, Trevor, you mentioned Leslie Manville, but at the same time, Vicky Cripps, who plays Alma, is just fantastic beginning to end for somebody who, I think she has quite a bit of acting credits, in foreign films, but I think she maybe is in like a handful of English language films, and she's just fantastic in here. She feels so natural, and she's just amazing. She did a great job as Alma and really brought that character to life. So how little is done, it's such a rich movie. And yeah, if this ends up winning Best Picture, I'm like, okay, I'm fine with that, because it's at least a good film, unlike Shape of Water, which is a bad film.
Man, I really need to see that. Is a good film. I really need to see it for what you guys you keep do. Saying no. about it. I have to see it now.
I just, I'm just out on that movie completely. And bums me out, because I love Guillermo del Toro, but I'm out completely on that movie. But that is all that we have for our review of Phantom Thread, which went quite a bit longer than I thought.
Yeah.
Quite a bit more to talk about. But let's go ahead and get to our content of the week. Trevor, what is your content of the week?
All right. A couple things. One, I know that I had to rescind a recommendation before with the TV show Battlestar Galactica. Well, I've given it another try. And if you power through a little bit through the first season, it becomes much, much, much more interesting at the end of the first season into the second, third. It touches on religion and spirituality in a way that sci-fi rarely, if ever, does, which makes it incredibly interesting in a lot of ways. It suffers a lot from being a show where 22 episodes were made in a season instead of 10 or 13, but that's, kind of run-of-the-mill stuff for TV, especially 10 years ago. But anyway, yeah, Battlestar Galactica, worth checking out if you're into sci-fi. It's pretty interesting. My other thing is if you liked Phantom Thread, or you kind of liked it, but it wasn't dramatic enough for you, then you should watch Downton Abbey. Because it's got it's an earlier time period, but a similar feel, similar kind of high society England kind of thing. And Downton Abbey does a great job of chronicling the changes in Western civilization at the beginning of the 20th century. It also is absurdly dramatic a lot of the time, and is just kind of a fun, serious but also guilty pleasure watch if you haven't watched Downton Abbey.
Alrighty. I have not watched Downton Abbey, and I think I watched like the first episode and was like, this feels like a soap opera.
Oh, it is.
My recommends this week, well, I'm going to first recommend something that Jake pointed out, was that Johan Johansson, who is a musician and composer from Iceland, passed away this past week, and his score on The Theory of Everything, the Stephen Hawking film, is fantastic, but some of his more notable scores are, he worked a lot with Denis Villeneuve. He did Arrival, Sicario, and Prisoners, and he had done a score for Blade Runner 2049 that a couple months before Denis felt just wasn't the right fit, and so ended up going with a different score. I think the same thing happened with him on Mother. He did a score for Mother, and instead Aronofsky kind of decided to go with a more high production sound design to give it that creepy feel. But thoughts go out to his family. Prayers with them. That's an incredibly sad situation for an incredibly talented composer who had a bright future ahead of him. My recommend for this week is, in honor of next week's film Black Panther, you should go ahead and go check out Fruitvale Station and Creed. Ryan Coogler, the director of Black Panther's two previous films, which both star Michael B. Jordan. Fruitvale Station is just a heartbreaking film about an incident at a train station. It's a true story from back in 2009 that's just heartbreaking, but what Coogler and Michael B. Jordan are able to do with that is just incredible. And then Creed, it's a boxing movie that's a Rocky film, but is the best Rocky film and is the best boxing movie. It's just incredible, and you know, I think Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan are going to be around for a while. So if you just can't get enough of those two people and you just can't wait for Black Panther, go ahead and watch those two. Or even if you've seen Black Panther, go ahead and watch those two because they're amazing. But that's all we have for this week. If you've enjoyed listening to us, go to iTunes, give us a review, rate us, let us know what you think. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if you really liked us, share us with a friend. Next time you go see a movie, tell the people that you're seeing the movie, hey, I love this movie podcast, and just share the podcast with them. That would mean a lot to us. If you want to interact more with us, you can find us online at popcornoptional.com with all of our episodes online at popcornoptional.com. You can also listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on multiple podcasting streaming websites. If you want to interact with us, you can email us at popcornoptional@gmail.com, but the best way would probably be to reach us on Twitter at popcornoptional. We also have a Facebook page at popcornoptional as well. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me online at 321CamiTime. Trevor, where can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TurboTrevor.
That's all we have for this week. Like we said earlier, we will be back next week with a review of Ryan Coogler's new film, Black Panther, from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we hope you guys have a great week, and we will be back ASAP as possible.